Brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry, this is the Chemistry World Podcast.
Hello, welcome to the July edition of the Chemistry World Podcast, which is brought to you this month by James Mitchell Crowe, Nina Notman, and Matt Wilkinson. In this episode, you've heard of spaceships. Well, in future, we've reason to think that they might really go sailing through space.
So, in practice, you would have an extremely large, highly reflective, but very, very lightweight mirror in space. And as sunlight reflects off the sail, the photons bounce off the sail, they impart a very small amount of momentum. And the sail experiences a tiny, tiny pressure, about maybe 1/1000th of the pressure of a feather resting in the palm of your hand. But that very small pressure is sufficient to accelerate the solar sail over a period of days, weeks, months or years.
That's Colin McInnes. He'll be explaining just how those solar sails work and what sorts of missions might benefit from them in just a moment. Also on the way, worrying news from the world of nanotubes, at least if you're a plant.
The carbon nanotubes were actually acting like tiny hypodermic needles. They were piercing the plant root cells and then effectively acting like a little tube through which other pollutants in the environment were very quickly then taken up inside the plant.
And strange goings on in the salt cellar too.
Most often you would imagine table salt to be a brittle crystalline material. If you have a salt crystal in front of you, you hit it with a hammer and it snaps. And you wouldn't expect to be able to pull it into nanowires. But that's exactly what Nathan Moore and his team at the Sandia National Laboratories in Albuquerque, New Mexico, have found.
So salty nanowires, seasoning perhaps for computer chips, who knows. Hello, I'm Chris Smith, and this is the Chemistry World Podcast.
The Chemistry World Podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.
These days, thanks to better nutrition, sanitation and healthcare, we're all living a lot longer. But longevity is something of a mixed blessing because it increases the risk of developing Alzheimer's disease. This is caused by the build-up in the brain of a protein called beta-amyloid, which kills nerve cells. But scientists have always struggled to explain exactly why this protein accumulates in the first place. But now, James, some light seems to have been shed on this problem.
This is a team led by Michael Bowers at the University of California, Santa Barbara, and they think, using a new mass spec technique, that they might have identified the primary toxic species behind the development of Alzheimer's disease and the formation of those big protein plaques that are associated with the brains of Alzheimer's patients.
Well, tell us a bit about those first. Actually, when you look in the brain of someone with Alzheimer's, what do you see and what's going on?
Basically, what you see are these long, rigid rods of misfolded proteins all clumped together. There's a couple of different forms of the amyloid beta protein, depending on exactly how many amino acids there are in the chain. The 42 amino acid long beta protein is believed to be the most toxic. So what they've done is compared how this forms the initial aggregates of the dimers and trimers against the 40 amino acid long peptide.
So what you're saying is that cells make this beta amyloid. There's a 42 amino acid form of this which in some way self-assembles to make these aggregates which are toxic. There's also a shorter form, the 40, which is less toxic, and this is kind of giving us some hints as to why we see that difference.
That's right. Well, that's what this team believe. So, as I say, what they've done is compared how these initial aggregates form. When they studied amyloid beta 42, they found that dimers formed, then they paired up to form tetramers, and then another dimer joined in to form the hexamer, and so on, till they've formed dodecamers. Whereas amyloid beta 40 formed dimers and then tetramers, but then the process really stopped there. From the tetramer to form these really long fibrils is an extremely slow process, whereas from the dodecamers to the fibrils is slightly quicker. So that's why they believe that the amyloid beta 42 might be the more toxic.
Answering an important question, but of course another important question to actually ask is, does this inform us of a way to interrupt the process or stop it so that people don't get Alzheimer's?
Well, they think that that actually might be the case. What they did was they used ion mobility studies. And basically, you can imagine this, it separates molecules based on their shape. And what they found is that amyloid beta 42 tetramer, the more toxic version, had quite an open shape. So if you could somehow interrupt that initial aggregation process, then they hope that that might be a way of treating and preventing the disease.
Let's hope so, because we're all getting older and we have an ageing population in the UK. I think something like one person in every five over the age of 75 gets Alzheimer's disease. So let's hope they solve that one before we all get there. Thank you very much, James. Now, from a pest in the brain to a pest in the garden, especially if you live in Australia, Matt, some friends of mine said they cannot have a wooden fence in Australia. They have to have a metal one, because if they do have a wooden fence, the termites get it. Now you might have the solution.
Well, it's not me that's got the solution, but some researchers from MIT and Northeastern University in Boston in the States have come up with a cheap, environmentally friendly way of killing termites. What they've done is they've had a look at how termites fight off various fungi, and they found that they recognise the fungi by the sugars that the fungi express on their surfaces. And when the termites actually see these sugars, it elicits an immune response, which allows the termites to kill them off, and they stay healthy. They then tried to look at blocking these receptors so that they could make the termites weaker.
So the termites have got some kind of chemical docking station or receptor that can spot something on the surface of the fungus, and that's how they know the fungus is there, or whatever they're reacting to. And you're saying that now scientists are looking for chemicals or molecules that will pretend to be a fungus, block up the molecule, and meanwhile the fungus or some other pathogen can sort of slip under the radar.
Exactly. In fact, they found that a certain sugar derivative known as D-delta glucanolactone can actually block these receptors so that the termites can't elicit an immune response. And they found that by adding this glucanolactone to termites in the presence of various fungi, the termites would die.
How do they seek to use this then? Can you get gluconolactone onto termites fairly easily? Where does it come from?
The gluconolactone that they used, they actually made in the laboratory, and it's a relatively simple molecule with just a couple of chiral centres. It's not too difficult to make, but it's actually also naturally occurring. And so they believe that while they could integrate the gluconolactone into nanoparticles, maybe paints, they also think that they could be produced genetically by engineered plants. So you could genetically engineer the plants that the termites eat, and then they would essentially be killing themselves by eating them.
Is it just termites, or given that they're insects and there are many members of the insect world, will this also hit other insects? So could that plant defence mechanism actually be a very good pesticide across the board?
It is quite widely applicable to quite a few different types of insect, not just cockroaches, but also locusts, which means that this gluconolactone might help in the pest control of up to three different insect groups, which could be a huge benefit. And obviously, this is all happening in an environmentally friendly way, which means that you don't have the problems associated with putting toxic chemicals into the environment, which the pests can actually become resistant to, and they can also bioaccumulate and cause problems to us if we eat products that they've accumulated in.
Death by green immunosuppression. What a wonderful concept. Thank you, Matt. Now, from environmentally friendly insect control to perhaps the greenest form of space travel, and that's using the power of the sun itself. Colin McInnes.
The idea of solar sailing is that you take a very thin, highly reflective membrane, you package it into the nose cone of a rocket, a conventional satellite launcher, and then in space you have a mechanical device, essentially a set of maybe kind of telescoping booms, which pull the sail film out and keep it in tension. So in practice, you would have an extremely large, highly reflective, but very, very lightweight mirror in space, perhaps 40 or 50 metres across. And as sunlight reflects off the sail and the little quantum packets of energy photons, which sunlight is composed of, and as the photons bounce off the sail, they impart a very small amount of momentum to it. And the sail experiences a tiny, tiny pressure, about maybe 1/1000th of the pressure of a feather resting in the palm of your hand. But that very small pressure is sufficient to accelerate the solar sail very slowly over a period of days, weeks, months, or years, and achieve very large changes in energy. So that means that solar sailing can be used for either very long duration or very high energy missions in the solar system.
Wasn't the first person to suggest that this might be possible, at least theoretically, someone about 300 or 400 years ago? It was Kepler, wasn't it, from his observations on comets?
Kepler noticed that comet tails always point away from the sun, and his hypothesis was that there was something emanating from the sun which pushed the comet tails away. It's light pressure, and it's the dust coming off the comet which is pushed away from the sun by the pressure of sunlight. And it's exactly the same physics which would be used to propel solar sail spacecraft through the solar system.
What sorts of speeds do you think you could get to with this technology then?
Well, it depends on the mission application. Depending on how you tilt the sail, how you orient the sail relative to the sun, you can either gain or lose energy. So, for example, you could spiral in close to the sun. You could perhaps do a mission to Mercury, which is actually very, very difficult to get to using conventional chemical rockets, because Mercury zips around the sun once every 88 days compared to the Earth's wedge-like 365 days around the sun. Or if you were to pass close to the sun, then the increased light pressure on the sail would accelerate the sail fairly quickly, and you could zip out to the outer solar system. One of the missions which we've investigated in the past for the European Space Agency is using a trajectory which does a close flyby of the sun to get to the distant outer solar system, the so-called heliopause, the very, very edge of the sun's influence, essentially the edge of interstellar space, and to get there in about 25 years, which is a task. It's almost impossible for conventional spacecraft, but would be achievable by solar sail spacecraft in the future.
So, practically speaking, how do you make this a reality?
Well, that's the question. There's been a number of studies done over the years, and we've been doing work for the European Space Agency. We've been evaluating different mission concepts. There's also been ground tests of solar sails, so kind of 20 by 20 metre sails, which have been deployed in the ground both in Europe and in the US. And really the technology is at a level now where there's a step change is required to go from ground testing and paper studies to actual flight demonstration.
But has no one actually tried testing the phenomenon, or at least got something into space to prove that this can work?
Not completely successfully. There's been a couple of attempts at flying a real solar sail. Back in the 1970s, the NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory had quite a serious concept for a solar sail mission to rendezvous with Comet Halley, and that then fell through due to funding issues. More recently, the Planetary Society in the United States had built a small solar sail, but unfortunately the launch vehicle failed. So there's not yet been a genuine solar sail demonstration in space, unfortunately.
What do you put that sort of indolence down to? Because, of course, this technology sounds like it could offer a huge amount.
It could, yeah. I mean, there's two sides to it. There's the push by engineers, if I can put it that way, who see solar sailing as a fairly romantic notion of sailing through space propelled by sunlight. But we have to be more hard-nosed than that, and we really have to identify what are the compelling practical or scientific applications of solar sails. And it's those applications which will pull the technology forward. And again, that's one of the things which we've been trying to identify through our work with the European Space Agency and others, the niche applications for solar sailing in the future.
And do you have any takers?
Through the work for the European Space Agency, we had identified a number of applications, such as going to the outer solar system very quickly using solar sails, doing sample return missions from very high energy objects, comets and asteroids, work which we've been doing with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration in America, essentially it's the American Met Office. And they're interested in solar sails, where you can use the pressure on the sail to hover stationary very, very high above the poles of the Earth for Earth observation and for poor climate monitoring.
So watch this space, ba-boom, for the first foray of solar sailing across the cosmos. That was Professor Colin MacInnes, who is at the University of Strathclyde.
If you're looking for highly qualified, experienced staff, or perhaps you're looking to make a career move yourself, then why not check out chemistryworldjob.org, which is a directory of the latest vacancies across the chemical sciences. And if you're an employer, you can place unlimited advertisements for both job vacancies or courses for free between the 1st of July and the 30th of September 2009, but you need to register now. To find out how, go to chemistryworldjobs.org.
This is the Chemistry World podcast with me, Chris Smith. Still to come, how nanotubes are harming the health of plants, fatal fungi, and turning table salt into nanowires. But first, Nina, scientists have discovered a way to make super-light molecular sponges that might soak up hydrogen, and we can use them in the fuel tanks of the future.
So these molecular sponges are porous crystals, and they're using it to either store hydrogen or to mop up greenhouse gases like methane and carbon dioxide.
Sounds intriguing to have a porous crystal. Are we talking about something... I mean, in the past on the Chemistry World podcast, we've talked about metal organic frameworks. These are these interesting structures where you have metal ions which are then covalently linked to non-metal ions, and the whole thing's like a repeating molecular cage which has a huge internal volume, so you can store gases in that very efficiently. Is this sort of a spin-off of that?
Yes, that's exactly right. Since 2005, they've been looking at taking the metal out of these. So these are covalent organic frameworks, and they just contain hydrogen, boron, carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen.
What's wrong with the metal?
The metals are heavier, so it's good to have a lighter, for example, fuel tank in your hydrogen-fueled car, and they're also obviously more expensive.
So if you can get rid of them, that's a good thing. And so what's the result? Does it work the same way if you get rid of the metal ions?
Yes, it works in the same way, in that the gases are still stored within the pores of the crystals.
What do they look like?
They consist of building blocks of five or six membered rings arranged into subunits, which have been bolted together with strong covalent bonds to form large crystalline frameworks.
How easy are they to make? Because it's easy for us to say, oh, look, you just make this molecule and it holds loads of hydrogen or whatever, but is that actually scalable? Can we make that?
The researchers say so. They've been able to make it on a fairly large scale in the lab, and they say that their synthesis is amenable to scale up.
Where will we see this applied, probably?
We'll find it hopefully in the fuel tanks of hydrogen-fueled vehicles, and also to mop up greenhouse gases coming out of the flumes of power plants.
So a bit like a molecular sieve. You could just sieve out the gases you don't want and constrain them inside these molecular sponges, effectively.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Thank you, Nina. So let's stick with the very small. And James, also potentially talking of pollutants and power plants and things, this is a pollutant-linked story, but it's about nanotubes, and it's actually quite scary.
Well, yeah, it is a little bit worrying. We hear all the time about how nanoparticles are amazing materials, and we can do this and that with them, and they're starting to be incorporated into products from paints and cosmetics to antibacterial socks. But the trouble is these things end up in the environment, and we're not quite sure what happens to them and what effect they have on the environment once they get there.
There was a wonderful item someone put together a couple of years ago, a big sign, like the kind of radioactive danger sign, but it was sort of nano hazard, and they were saying, you know, we just don't know what the consequences of these tiny things we pump into the environment is. There might not be one, but on the other hand, there might. No one knew asbestos was bad until people started to develop mesotheliomas and lung cancers.
Well, that's quite the problem, and it's very difficult to come up with ways to sort of to manage the problem if you don't actually know what the particles are doing in the first place. So this team at the University of Lancaster, Edward Wild and Kevin Jones, they've looked at a small piece of this puzzle and looked at how certain nanoparticles in combination with other pollutants that are out there in the environment affect living plant tissues.
How have they done it? What were they looking at?
Well, what they've done is used near-infrared to build up 3D pictures of living plant tissue. Near-infrared actually penetrates tissue quite well, so they can build up a picture 3 to 5 cells deep. And what the technique relies on is the fact that some of these particles naturally fluoresce under this wavelength, and so they don't need to tag the nanoparticles. They can just directly look at where they go within the plant cells.
So was this done in culture then? They've got a petri dish and some plant growing in it, and you put a sprinkle of nanoparticles on there and then basically see where they go. Is that what they were doing?
Yes, it's essentially that sort of thing. So what they've looked at is multi-wall carbon nanotubes, titanium dioxide and cerium dioxide, and looked at whether that affects the plant's ability to repel, if you like, phenanthrene, which is a common polyaromatic hydrocarbon, which is sort of comes out of burning fossil fuels.
Well, that would be in the soil. So the test here is, does this stuff get into a plant normally? With these nanoparticles around, does it get into the plant more, indicating that they're in some way making the plant more permeable to that stuff getting in.
Exactly right, exactly right. They found with titanium dioxide and cerium dioxide, what these nanoparticles tend to do was just sort of clump together and maybe stick to the outside of the plant roots, but weren't really causing any problems. But rather more sinister, the carbon nanotubes were actually acting like tiny hypodermic needles. They were piercing the plant root cells and then effectively acting like a little tube through which other pollutants in the environment were very quickly then taken up inside the plant.
What could be the consequence of that?
That's the bigger question. That's the next question. What this research shows is that all sorts of other pollutants could be taken up by the plant in a similar way through these little nanotubes.
I would say, though, James, that one kind of critical thing here is that this is obviously a carefully controlled experiment, presumably not done in real soil, therefore in a real kind of dirt, get-your-hands-dirty environment. So do you think this really will happen in the average garden, the average farmer's field, or is this going to be a bit artificial?
Well, as you say, I mean, to be able to monitor where the particles are going, it's obviously all done in the lab. It definitely suggests that in the natural environment, this same process could be occurring and that the nanoparticles could be interacting with other pollutants to have this sort of cumulative effect.
Which is worrying, and it certainly suggests that out of sight mustn't mean out of mind, because scientists absolutely need to follow that finding to discover the true risks that are associated with working with nanotubes. Thank you, James. And now, a special treat in the form of a foray into the realms of our special podcast, Chemistry in Its Element, where each week we take a look at the sometimes sinister side of the periodic table. And in this episode, UCL chemist Andrea Sella looks at the story of erbium.
A couple of years ago, a colleague popped his head round my door and said, as chemists do, "I'm on the scrounge." It's quite common in chemistry departments. You want to do a quick experiment and just want a smidge of something without having to order a whole bottle. So you ask a friend whether they've got a bit of whatever. "Have you got some erbium oxide?" "Sure," I said. "I've got some up in the lab." And a few minutes later, my friend went off with a small bottle containing a delicate pink-colored powder. A few weeks later, I saw him in the stairwell and asked him how he'd got on with the erbium. "It's amazing stuff. You have to see this," he replied. He pulled out of his pocket a sample vial containing some stunning pink crystals that glinted alluringly. "Wow," I said. You can always impress a chemist with nice crystalline products. "It gets better," he said mysteriously. He beckoned me into a hallway that had recently been refurbished. "Look," he said. As the crystals caught the light from the new fluorescent lamps hanging from the ceiling, the pink color seemed to deepen and brighten up. "Wow," I said again. We moved the crystals back into the sunlight, and the color faded again. And moving the crystals back and forth, they glowed and dimmed in magical fashion. It was a stunning example of the luminescence which is so common amongst the rare earths, of which erbium is a member. The red phosphor in the fluorescent lights must have contained erbium ions, and since the emission wavelength of the phosphor exactly matched the absorption in my friend's crystals, resonant absorption was occurring, causing the magical glow. The rare earths were revealed to the world quite by accident by a Swedish lieutenant and rockhound, Carl Axel Arrhenius, in 1787, in a quarry on the island of Vaxholm in Sweden, where the small town of Utterbo is located. The mineral that Arrhenius had found would lead to the discovery of 16 elements, all of them with remarkably similar properties. And the small village of Utterbo would provide the inspiration for the names of several of them: ytterbium, yttrium, terbium, and the element of this podcast, erbium. Others got names like scandium, holmium, thulium in recognition of the region whence they'd first appeared. For over a century, controversy raged amongst chemists about these elements, and one of the key players in this chemical row was Robert Bunsen, the co-inventor with Gustav Kirchhoff of spectroscopy. Together, they'd had the idea of putting chemical compounds into a flame and analyzing the resulting light with a prism. The spectra they observed proved to be amazing analytical tools. Kirchhoff would use the method to identify elements in the sun. The method rapidly became one of the central pillars of chemistry. But like many others working in the area, Bunsen was intrigued by the faint colors of the rare earths and their remarkable invariance. Erbium compounds, regardless of the partner, the oxide, chloride, fluoride, amide, hydrocarbiles, are almost invariably faint pink. Over a period of 3 long years, Bunsen methodically carried out the hundreds of crystallizations needed to purify the elements, and then meticulously measured and sketched the spark spectra, which contained many sharp bands of varying intensities. It was a spectroscopic tour de force for its time. And at last, in May 1874, Bunsen finished writing his monumental manuscript. With a feeling of relief, he finally headed off to the local pub for lunch. Imagine the poor man's horror when he got back to the lab and the manuscript was gone. A round-bottomed flask of water on the desk had focused the spring sunshine from the window and set fire to the entire pile. Years of work reduced to ashes, and after venting his despair in a couple of letters to friends, Bunsen painstakingly redid the work from scratch, laying the foundation of our understanding of the electronic structures of elements such as erbium. We now realize that the valence electrons of erbium, of which there are 11 in its compounds, are buried deep within the core of the atom, and their location makes them remarkably insensitive to the world outside, which is why the colors are so consistent from one compound to the next. But what Bunsen could not know was that there were also spectroscopic bands in the infrared part of the spectrum, and it is these that are what makes erbium so valuable to us today. As you're probably aware, most of our telephone calls and internet data transfers are carried by optical fibers, and these gossamer-thin threads of glass are of a rare optical perfection. But much like light passing through the atmosphere, scattering occurs. Photons of light collide occasionally with the chains of glass in the fiber, and that light is attenuated, limiting the length of fiber one can use. This phenomenon, called Rayleigh scattering, is the same that causes the daytime sky to be blue and sunsets to be red. The shorter the wavelength, the greater the scattering. Erbium light, at 1.55 microns in the near-infrared region of the spectrum, falls right where Rayleigh scattering is at a minimum, but away from where bond vibrations in the glass absorb infrared light. Erbium lasers and amplifiers are therefore the hub around which all of our modern telecommunications revolve. So the next time you phone a friend and say to them, "It's a lovely day, let's go to the park," think erbium. It may only be the 44th most abundant element on our planet, but it punches far above its weight.
And it probably also made it possible for you to listen to this podcast too. That was Andrea Seller with the story of erbium. You can hear the inside stories on lots more elements like that by subscribing to the Chemistry in Its Element podcast, which you can find on iTunes. You can also listen to it or download it from our website at chemistryworld.org/elements. Now, Nina, fatal fungi. Tell us how scientists have got to the bottom of this mystery.
So these Asian mushrooms have been responsible for 7 deaths in Western Japan where people have accidentally ingested them. And researchers wanted to find out what the toxic molecule was in the mushroom.
So what happens to the people who eat them?
Well, they suffer from a breakdown of muscle fibres, which eventually causes kidney failure and then death.
Is this common?
No, it's really uncommon. There's only been 7 deaths since the 1950s.
But do people know which particular mushrooms are implicated? I mean, what's the problem?
No, that was part of the problem, is that there's a number of mushrooms that look really very similar, and that's the first thing the researchers had to do. They had to work out which mushroom was responsible.
So how do they do that?
Well, they got samples of all of the different mushrooms that were suspected, and they fed them to mice, and they saw which mice suffered.
Okay, and that tells you basically which mushroom species. How do you then link that to what's actually the culprit chemically in the mushroom?
So once they've identified their mushroom, they then soak it in water and separate all the compounds which come out, and they then yet again feed these compounds to the mice and see which compound is responsible, and then they worked out the structure of the compound. The one responsible is a highly strained 3-membered ring, cyclopropturine carboxylic acid. And this is a really unusual structure, and it's not been seen in nature before. These 3-membered rings are highly strained and really reactive, and normally in nature they will have 2 or 3 substituents on them to make them more stable.
And they're missing in this instance.
And in this instance there's only one substituent, the carboxylic acid.
So it's pretty unusual, which begs obviously 2 questions. One, where the mushrooms got it from, which I guess is an ongoing investigation really. But 2, why? It seems like an amazing case of overkill.
I guess that they have these toxins for the same reason that most things have toxins, which is protect themselves from predators.
So how do I recognise things so I don't accidentally eat one?
Oh, well, the best way is to have a look at our website.
Which is, of course, chemistryworld.org. Thank you, Nina. Now, Matt, this is very interesting. You've badged this salt nanowire surprise, and it quite literally is. This is sodium chloride doing something very unexpected and exciting.
Yes, indeed. Most often you would imagine table salt to be a brittle crystalline material. If you have a salt crystal in front of you, you hit it with a hammer and it snaps. And you wouldn't expect to be able to pull it into nanowires. But that's exactly what Nathan Moore and his team at the Sandia National Laboratories in Albuquerque, New Mexico, have found. They were investigating water absorption onto salt crystals using a technique known as interfacial force microscopy. And they found some unusual force behaviour between the tip of the microscope probe and the surface. And they didn't really know what to do and what they were seeing. And so they put the salt in a transmission electron microscope and saw these nanowires.
When you say nanowire, what do you actually mean?
Well, basically, they'd taking the tip of this interfacial force microscope, they'd basically been able to stretch the salt and form wires that were nanometers in width and very, very long. I mean, up to more than their own length before, more than twice their own length before breaking.
We're pretty used to the structure of sodium chloride being this very regular crystal architecture. We learn to draw it in physics lessons and chemistry A-level lessons. How can it possibly deform to make these funny wires then?
The researchers believe it could well be down to the electron beam itself that comes out of the force microscope. And what they think it does is that it changes the sodium ions into sodium atoms. And by doing that, it breaks the crystal structure itself. So the interaction between the sodium atoms and the chloride ions aren't as strong. And that means that then the crystal structure is slightly disrupted, turns it into a little bit of a molten situation where they can then pull it apart. When the electron beam's then turned off, the crystal reforms. But they have noticed that actually that there's a little bit more metallic sodium in there than there might have been beforehand.
But when you make these wires, are they stable? So in other words, if I were to make one of these wires, bend it round into all kinds of exciting shapes, say I could, and then I take the electron effect away, does it stay locked in that configuration then?
Absolutely, yes. But even more interesting than just staying locked in that configuration, if they put the tip back on it, then they can push it back together again. So it's completely reversibly deformable, which is amazing considering this is sodium chloride.
And academically very interesting, obviously. But the key thing here is, can we use this, or are there other spin-offs? Does it inform other aspects of chemistry?
Well, as you can imagine, Chris, actually having a useful material made out of sodium chloride is pretty difficult because there's water everywhere and it would just dissolve. So what they actually believe the usefulness of this is that it may well help to understand the properties of geological salt deposits, which can deform when they come into contact with moisture. It may also help understand sea salt aerosols, and maybe also understand the role that salt plays in cloud nucleation and smog formation. The application of this is really indeed bettering our understanding of many different aspects of where salt is involved in the environment.
Incredible. Who would have thought you could turn salt into wires? Thank you, Matt. Right, well, that's almost it for this month. There's just time to take a look at the chemical conundrum from last time. So what was it you wanted to know, Nina?
And we wanted to know, what were the Incas mining that caused mercury pollution in the Andes mountains thousands of years ago?
And the answer was cinnabar, or mercury sulfide. And they were using this to make vermilion, an orange-red pigment used to decorate ceremonial objects and the bodies of their dead elite.
It's very beautiful. I think Chinese emperors used to also have it because they thought it would make them live longer. How wrong they were, because it's obviously got mercury in it, it's very bad for you. Any winners?
Yeah, and the winner is Linus Rakenbach from Karlsberg in Germany, and he wins one of our Chemistry World goodie bags.
Much sought after. And here's how you can win one next month.
This month's question is a revealing insight into science in Victorian Britain. The question is, what did British scientist William Byrd Herapath discover in 1852 when he added tincture of iodine to the urine of dogs that had been fed quinine? The answer to the question can be found on the Chemistry World blog, which can be found at chemistryworld.org/blog. And if you can find the right answer, would you please send it to chemistryworld@rsc.org.
Thanks, Matt. And you can use that same address to send us any feedback that you might have about this or one of our previous programmes. This month's show was brought to you by Nina Notman, James Mitchell Crowe, and by Matt Wilkinson. The production was by Mira Senthilingam. And I'm Chris Smith from thenakedscientist.com. Until next time, thank you for listening, and goodbye!